Good afternoon. I call this meeting of the Job Growth, Energy, Affordability, Policy, and Finance Committee to order. Today is Wednesday, March 21st. The first order of business is approval of the minutes dated March 20th. Representative Mahoney moves approval of the March 20th minutes. Any corrections, changes, additions, or subtractions? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Members, we have three bills on the agenda for today, and then we're going to be hearing from the governor's staff regarding the governor's supplemental budget recommendations. First one is House File 3711. Welcome to the Jobs Committee. Chairman Davids, the chair will move House File 3711 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Taxes. Well, isn't that convenient? Representative Davids, do you have any amendments for your bill that you need?
I believe we do.
All right. There is a DE1 amendment. Is that the author's amendment to get the bill in the form that the author would like?
Yes, sir.
All right. And members, your research summary that's in your packet is conformed to that. Representative Metza, did you have a question? Or?
Okay. I was just eating some tangerine.
Gotcha. So, again, members, the chair will move the DE1 amendment to get the bill in the form that Representative Davids would like. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The DE1 amendment is adopted. Any other amendments, Representative Davids?
Not that I'm aware of, Mr. Chairman.
Well, to your bill. Have at it.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. House File 3711, as amended, is a bill that basically what we're looking at is developing downtown Duluth and redeveloping some of downtown Duluth as a medical center, where there would be about an $850 million investment in that area. And as you read through the bill, they're looking at a lot of these issues are tax issues, but for the Jobs Committee, we are looking at quite a few jobs here. So at this point, I have a couple of witnesses. This bill is being sponsored by myself, Representative Schultz, Murphy, and Olson, and there's others too. But I'd like to turn over to the testifiers, but before I do that, I'd like to turn over to Representative Schultz for a few comments, and then we'll go into our testimony.
Thank you, Representative Davids. Representative Schultz, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Jen Schultz, and I'm delighted that you're hearing this bill. Duluth hasn't seen a lot of development in our inner city for a long time, and it's been really difficult to get developers to come and build, especially for workforce and affordable housing. So we're hoping this can spur development and also give us a new hospital and clinics for Essentia's $850 million investment. They're the largest employer in the city after UMD, so we're grateful that they want to stay in Duluth in the city and invest.
Sir, Mr. Chairman, and when I say $850 million, that's not an ask for the state. That's what a private company is willing to put into this project, so we probably should clear that up quite quickly.
Well, Representative Davids, that money would come out of your target, not mine, so that's your problem.
So I can turn over to the doctor here. If you could please provide your testimony.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with the testimony.
Sure. My name is Dan Nikovich, and I serve as an oncologist at Essentia Health in Duluth, Minnesota. I also serve as president of our East Market of Essentia Health, which is our largest portion of Essentia. And I'm privileged to be here and talk about what our organization wishes to do in Duluth. And as you heard, we intend to make an investment well north of $800 million in the city of Duluth, and it's in large part because we need new facilities to match how the practice of medicine has transformed. I can tell you that I've been living in Duluth for 16 years, and in that 16 years, the practice of medicine and taking care of our patients and all that we serve in northern Minnesota has changed dramatically. I think the committee members may have a picture of some things. Is that right? Of our slides of some things. Is that right?
That we do. It's the Visit Northland.
Right, the Visit Northland. And if you flip to the second page, there's a green map, and that's Essentia. That's our footprint. And of northern Minnesota, of where we are. And as I mentioned, our practice has changed dramatically and significantly. Our facilities have not kept pace. St. Mary's was built originally in 1920, and there's been a number of other buildings added since that time. It's actually a collection of nine buildings, and many of which are outdated. We have semi-private rooms. It's difficult to care for patients in those spaces. And at the same time, medicine has largely changed to an outpatient practice, and we have to update our same facilities. And what we intend to do in that space is to consolidate our practice into an area in another part of our campus. It's further on in the pictures. Mr. Chairman, I'll show you this picture a little bit further on. It's a conceptual rendering. And it includes a new tower for St. Mary's. We'd rebuild St. Mary's Medical Center. A tower for a new ambulatory clinic building with spaces that connect the two. We would also subsequently vacate the land on which St. Mary's is at present time. And that would be allow it for other purposes, especially multi-generational housing and other areas that are of significant need in that part of the neighborhood of Duluth. This downtown campus here in Duluth is where we do a lot of complex care. The difference between us and, for example, Mayo Clinic is that we don't do transplant. We do everything else. And we're a destination site for many of our patients in northern Minnesota. The realities of Medicare or medical reimbursement are such that much of our reimbursement, much of our revenue is generated out of our downtown campus, as a consequence of how medicine's reimbursed. Those resources we generate there allows us, in turn, to reinvest into the rest of the communities we serve in northern Minnesota. Case in point being our clinic in Grand Rapids that will open in about 3 weeks. Other investments we've made in other cities, in Sandstone, our newest facility, in fact, until Grand Rapids opens, Virginia, I Falls, Hibbing, other facilities that we've invested in. Much of the resources come out of this main campus. And the key thing is we have to transform our facilities to match how the practice of medicine has changed. We keep this in the spirit of how the sisters at the College of St. Scholastica started everything well over 100 years ago. We take special concern and care of the poor and powerless. We serve everyone that we see. And yet we have to still generate the resources in order to meet our mission to make a healthy, in our calling to make a healthy difference in people's lives. We're very excited about being able to make this investment in the city of Duluth. And because I believe not only will obviously help our organization to best serve our patients and communities of northern Minnesota, but I believe it will also serve as a very important economic catalyst for development in the city of Duluth and surrounding areas. Much the same way that our other investment, First Street Building opened in 2006, $100 million, was a significant catalyst for the development of downtown Duluth, the Sheraton off a hotel building, other things that occurred on Superior Street as a result of that investment. I believe this investment will spur the same, but on a much larger scale.
Thank you. Do you have other invited testifiers?
Yes, one more. Yeah.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Garofalo. My name is David Montgomery. I'm the Chief Administrative Officer for the City of Duluth. Mayor Emily Larson sends her regards, but she's homesick today and could not be here, so I'm standing in for her. On behalf of the city, our testimony here is very much in support of this project. We are very excited for this major infusion of new development dollars and expansion capability and upgrading of our largest employer, Essentia Health. And we think this will have very positive impacts in a otherwise somewhat economically distressed area of Central and East Hillside Duluth, where the St. Mary's campus and Essentia campuses already are located. By moving down the hill a couple of blocks, it, as the doctor mentioned, it frees up some of that space up on top of the hill along 4th Street, 5th Street, and the opportunity for much-needed housing, not only in support of our medical communities as part of their recruitment and retention efforts, but also for the community at large that surrounds these campuses is very, very exciting on behalf of the, you know, from the city's point of view. So we are here in support of this project. We are working actively with Essentia, working out some of the details around this, and we fully expect to get all those sorts of issues resolved over the next couple of weeks. But we are eager and happy to be here in support of this development.
Representative Davis, do you have any other invited testifiers?
I do not. We'd stand for questions or whatever the chair would prefer here.
This is a public hearing. Are there any other members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion. Move to member questions and comments. Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question I have, we've seen and we've heard some of the small communities from around Rochester that with the major investment that happened at Mayo, and they've seen a lot of their small clinics in their areas close. And I represent Sandstone, where we're thankful to have the new clinic. But will these major investments in Duluth potentially cause some of these rural communities to lose their clinics and hospitals, like what happened with the Mayo Clinic?
The testifiers?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Rarick. I'm not aware of any clinic that closed because of the DMC in Rochester. If you're aware of any, let me know, because I'm not aware of anybody that closed.
Representative Rarick.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I don't remember the exact community. We've had two that we've heard of in property taxes that they're looking for an exemption because they were affiliated with the Mayo Clinic. They then closed, and now they're hoping to get an exemption so somebody else could come in.
Well, then, Davis, I think you're talking about Albert Lea.
They're talking about Albert Lea, and they didn't close Albert Lea. They did move some services from Albert Lea to Austin, and there is a bill that Representative Bennett has that we're working on to try and help them out in Albert Lea for those services. So I thought I wasn't aware of any clinics that closed. They did move, I think, two services to Austin, but the Albert Lea clinic is still open.
Additional testifiers, just to offer any additional info on that?
We're going to maintain our presence and can plan to continue to invest in our communities in which we serve. We will be adding services to Sandstone, by the way.
Representative Metza.
That's a very good idea. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I can attest that they do let anyone in. They do do my hospital work for our family at the hospital in Virginia. And it's where my wife and I had our son last year. We were fortunate to be able to do that in our community, and we wouldn't be able to if Essentia wasn't there. And, you know, I think one you left out, Aurora, where you have a clinic as well, is a huge asset to that community with projects that haven't come to fruition yet. Pending, we could really continue to use the investment which you've been making. And so I think this would tie it all together and essentially put us in a really good regional position, Doctor, to have the services that people are fearing losing, essentially, and save quite a few people, quite a few miles driving down to the metro area or to Rochester to be able to receive those services locally. And so I think this is a good investment for the state, a good investment for the city, and a huge investment on behalf of the sisters, which good thing no one from the public testified against them. So we appreciate the continued work here and look forward to seeing this bill go through in Texas, Mr. Chair.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we're in the Jobs Committee. I was just curious if you have an estimation of how many jobs will be added and what types of jobs, what kind of benefits, what kind of pay level.
To either of the testifiers?
Present time, our average wage is $80,000 for our Essentia employees. And as we grow our services there, we will need to add additional employees. In fact, we anticipate that upwards of 40% of our workforce could retire in the next 10 years. We have to replace them and want to recruit to replace them and to continue to grow. So I do not foresee a reduction in our workforce as a result.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonilla.
So for the $800 million investment, though, with this huge expansion, do you have a sense as to how many jobs you'll be adding? I'm assuming you're going to add jobs because you're doing a massive expansion. Do you have a sense as to how many jobs that might be and what types of jobs that it would be? And the reason I ask is I've actually toured down in Rochester, and some of the concerns I heard even among those that were heavily invested in, you know, the Destination Medical Center were that so many of the jobs were lower income, service type jobs. So I'm just curious as to what your plan is and what your expectations are.
Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. My name is Gary Serfenik. I represent Essentia. Mr. Chairman, representative, the campus is not going to add any hospital beds, and I think that's the key thing. The current St. Mary's Hospital has two beds for each room, and we have 154 entrances, for example, in that hospital. We're building a new hospital with the same number of beds, but private rooms, and three entrances. It's modernizing a very old facility that is structurally not sound, that's several blocks away from other parts of our system. And so it's very difficult for patients and for doctors to provide quality care for those patients. So the amount of jobs won't grow dramatically with the new facility because it's a replacement for the old facility. Where the jobs and the estimates from the analysis will be within the medical district because of the new facility closer to the lake, freeing up a lot of land that Essentia currently has a footprint on for multi-generational housing for economic development purposes, with discussions with the University of Minnesota, the potential to move the medical campus down to this medical district, the pharmacy campus down to this medical district. That's where the estimates of the new jobs will grow over a 20-year period. Currently, Essentia has 5,300 full-time equivalents in Duluth, 16,000 within the region, 75 clinics, 15 hospitals. This is the mothership that provides, as the doctor noted, economic benefits that are spread throughout the region, throughout rural Minnesota, to those hospitals and clinics.
Representative Lanier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So specifically to what types of jobs, and one concern that was in Rochester is that they're expanding as well. You're moving, so it's not as much of an expansion. But there was such a concern that so many of the jobs were actually very low-paying service-type jobs. And so can you speak to what types of jobs will be added? And you said very few new jobs, but as you're shifting and, you know, redeveloping and all of that, is this going to be more of a service-type, you know, retail service, restaurant, that type of redevelopment, or what's the redevelopment?
Mr. Stravanek, the other testifiers.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Neal, the jobs, and I think maybe the city chief administrative officer Montgomery could attest to this as well, but with the movement of the campus down to the site, those would be very high-quality jobs associated with the University of Minnesota. If the university makes that decision, and I'm not testifying that they have made that decision, we're in discussions with them. Secondly, potential for hotel developments. One of the key components of this is the capping of I-35. As many of you have driven through Duluth, I-35 is capped in a couple spots, and there's an opening. There'll be a cap put on there as part of the DOT's long-term plan, that there'll be a parking ramp built. That would free up a current parking ramp that's not exactly located in the right spot in Duluth. It's right on the lakefront. Move that in the back, provide more development on the lakefront. So I think it is that combination of retail, hotel, university, education components, medical technology, those types of jobs.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There should be a letter in your packet from the building trades authored by former Representative Carly Moline and supporting this project, because there will be new jobs in the construction and development of the new hospital. But I would envision that we would have more employers moving into our community if we had workforce housing and more housing. And so we're hoping the housing, making more new housing available, will bring employers, new businesses to the Duluth community that would create new jobs.
Representative Davids?
And thank you, Mr. Chairman, being the Jobs Committee, as the doctor said, we're not adding beds. We're not adding beds. So that may be a bit static, but the spinoff jobs from this and the construction itself for the $850 million, or whatever that is, will be a lot of union trade jobs. And what we're witnessing in Rochester, I mean, what got me excited about this project for the Duluth area is what's going on in Rochester. And this is not DMC. This is not DMC Light. Very, very different as far as the funding and all of that. But there will be many, many jobs. I mean, if you're going to spend $850 million on buildings and infrastructure, I don't know how many jobs that is over the next 4 or 5 years, but it's a lot. And maybe we could do a little bit more research on that and get some better numbers for the committee. But like I said, it's not just the hospital or the clinic.
it's the spinoff. I mean, Rochester is just growing like you wouldn't believe with the buildings and the bioscience and all the things that are going on there. So you've got DMC, but then you've got all the ancillary spinoffs of what's going there. And I think you'll see some of that to some extent in Duluth if we get this going.
Yes, that's fine.
So, Mr. Chairman, another thing I want to add, the same areas will be replaced. It's approximately 400 beds, and present time we'd estimate that would be the size of the new one. However, we are adding capacity, and that's going to be with what we do in an outpatient space because that's where medicine's going. So it's not going to be static in the sense to our footprint necessarily, but our capacity to care for our patients will, in fact, expand. The number one reason that we are challenged in recruiting in Duluth is for the trailing spouse. The spouse cannot find a job. Someone from the family cannot find a job. And we hope with our investment here to spur that economic development, we'll be able to recruit and retain not only those folks that would like to work for Essentia and be part of our team, but also in the greater area as well.
Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to thank Chair Davids for spearheading this effort. It's a tremendous benefit for the regional medical needs to upgrade this hospital. The services there in St. Mary's have been absolutely terrific. I've got several living family members to attest to that. And that was supposed to be good, okay. But as far as the building goes, the needs are great to replace what people refer to as the mothership of essential services there. So really excited to be a part of this. I'd like to give a little comfort to Representative Rarick on his concerns about some of the satellite hospitals around there. Cloquet Hospital has been a standalone hospital for many years, and it's probably the closest one to Duluth, and they're in good shape and good partnership between the physicians, and that's existed for several decades. So I hope that gives you a little bit of comfort there. So thank you.
Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the things I heard said on the representative just maybe expanded a little bit. I'm wondering if we could hear a little more about the housing portion of this. That really is seems to be a very important part of it. And I didn't see it in the bill when I was looking. And I'm assuming that maybe some of the deconstruction as well as some of the new construction must be related to housing. And maybe you could talk a little bit about that and who would be served or the kind of housing that would be created. And, sounds like a really important part for the community.
Doctor, the other testifier, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative. The housing is one of the key elements that the city is really quite excited about. We have been dealing with a housing problem in Duluth for a long time. We've got a lot of housing, but our housing stock is 60% of it is built before 1935. And so to the recruitment concepts that not only Essentia, our other hospitals, St. Luke's, our banks, Cirrus, all of our major employers, when they try to recruit people to come, that's one of the issues they have, is people can't find the kind of housing they are used to or are thinking of within the area well at hand. We also have a lot of need for affordable housing and workforce housing as well. And so this concept, when it came to us, with the idea that Essentia would move those 2 to 3 blocks down the hill. When you look at the area around Essentia now, it's obviously those buildings, and within the bill it does talk about project dollars being potentially deconstruction or rehabilitation of buildings. That is part of exactly what is in mind, is dealing with some of those facilities. But there's also a lot of parking lots up there. A lot of parking lots when you look up along 4th and 5th Street. And that's open space available for redevelopment once those parking needs are met down near the buildings down along 35. And so we view that. The city's very excited about the opportunity to open up that space for housing, not only to support the medical facilities and their recruitment and their hiring efforts, but also for the communities of the Central and East Hillsides as well, which are some of our most at-need communities up in Duluth. So we're very excited about what this opens up in terms of housing. We think the bill provides, as part of that public infrastructure, the opportunity to utilize some of those funds for very much those purpose of clearing those sites and preparing those sites for housing opportunities.
Mr. Chairman, that's good. I couldn't find it in the book. Can you tell me where it is? I just wanted to look at it. This committee does deal with housing. It's part of our mission, so I'm glad that that's part of this bill. It's very appropriate. I just couldn't find it. Maybe you could show me later, if nothing else, but I would like to see the language.
The testifiers could follow up with Representative Clark at the conclusion of the hearing. That work out?
Yeah, I can.
Okay. Representative Mahoney. Okay. Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Very visionary, very big thinking long term. My question would be, the folks at Essentia, have you been working with the University of Minnesota as well with possibly expanding the medical school services or training and teaching? Because as we here in Health and Human Services here in St. Paul, we have such a need for rural providers and keeping people in Duluth in that kind of that metro setting, but yet still rural. That was my idea or the thoughts of just asking the question if possibly this dream would be something that would also expand medical school services up in Duluth through the university.
Neither of the testifiers?
So, Mr. Chair and Representative, thanks for your question. Yes, we have had conversations with the university, and they are ongoing. There's a conceptual drawing in the packet that includes, in fact, a tower that could represent that for a medical space or academic space for the University of Minnesota, not just the medical school, but for other disciplines and sciences that are presently at the university. Personally, I would love it if we had a four-year medical school in Duluth. It's presently 2 years, and the students finish elsewhere, typically in Minneapolis. I teach there at the medical school. It's a wonderful resource, and as you point out, the graduates of that program largely go back to serve in northern Minnesota and rural communities and so forth. So, yes, we're having those conversations, and it would be spectacular, I think, if that came to fruition in some manner similar to what's on the conceptual drawings.
Representative Fabian.
Mr. Chair, may I respond to Representative Baker?
Representative Schultz, my apologies.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Baker, we would be happy to entertain expanding the Academic Health Center in the School of Medicine and the College of Pharmacy if you'd be willing to appropriate some money to do that. I know I've been working with the Associate Dean of the School of Medicine at the University of Minnesota that's housed on the Duluth campus, and they are thinking about expanding and creating a large academic health center. So I think that vision maybe is 5 years away, and I don't want to speak for the university, but I've been in some of those discussions as part of their advisory board.
My only follow-up would be I couldn't agree more. I think that we support the University Twin Cities campus immensely with bonding projects and future things. So with this kind of a dream plan, if we didn't do some major expansions and have a four-year medical school and really think outside the box, this is where some of those next dollars should go. That's coming out of the state for those instead of maybe the Twin City campus. So I just wanted to share that. Thanks.
We could always repurpose some broadband funding, too. Representative Davis?
You can go there, too.
Mr. Chair, that's up to you. To Representative Clark's question, if you look at the bill, page 2, 2.1, subdivision 5, public infrastructure project, you go down, that kind of, I think, answers Representative Clark's question.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Davis, thanks for bringing the bill forward. So much of what I've heard from the testifiers here today are a lot of the things that many of us advocate for. Recruitment of jobs, workforce housing, all kinds of different things that impact all of us all across the state of Minnesota, and I've been working hard on a lot of those things myself. Particularly in the bill, I'm looking at page 4, 4.19, and it talks about American-made steel. I'm a big fan of American-made steel, especially if it's made right here and mined right here in Minnesota. And I am curious about line 4.21, where it has the exception by public law, and you can read the numbers and so forth there. I've given staff a little bit of a heads up that I've been asked this question. I'm wondering what the exceptions are.
Does nonpartisan staff want to cover those exceptions?
I can cover that, Mr. Chair.
Let's go to you. Staff doesn't get it right. You prefer Metsa to do it?
We can do it.
All right. Mr. Weeks?
Mr. Chair, there are three exceptions in that public law, which was a part of the 2019 public infrastructure investment. I think it's using American-made steel would not be in the public interest. There isn't enough supply of American-made steel, or using American-made steel would raise the cost 25% or more, is my understanding.
And Representative Metz had not just had an affirming fashion, so we'll take that as facts.
Mr. Chair, there's actually another reason, too. It actually keeps us compliant with our trade agreements on a global level, and those percentages stay within those parameters on a federal level.
The best trade deals, the best trade deals. Believe me, I know. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just, I talked to Mr. Weeks here. He said 2019, but I know he meant 2009. So, one of the other things that I think could create lots of jobs across the part of the state that I represent is, and would use American steel, and would be to put some pipes in the ground. I'm concerned that the Line 3 replacement project is something that's important for my constituents and so forth. I would certainly hope that all the people who are sitting at the witness table are supporting the Line 3 replacement across northern Minnesota, and we can use American-made steel and put lots of Minnesotans back to work in the kinds of jobs that are good-paying, high-paying, have a very bright future. So to the testifiers, do you support the Line 3 replacement?
You probably don't have a position on that.
That greatly expands the scope of the
discussion.
I'll answer for me, yes. Representative Fabian brings up a very, very good point about the provisions there regarding American-made steel, and they're on page, what page are they on? Page 6. And I would like to just visit a little bit about that. Let's have it on. Where's American-made steel?
Page 4.
I was just reading it. Okay. Mr. Chairman and members, page 4, lines 4.19. We may have to do a bit of work on that because even in President Trump's tariffs, Canada was excluded. And one concern I have here, Mr. Chairman, is if we kind of go down that road with our friends from the north, where do you draw the line? Because much of the steel that they manufacture is from the Iron Range. The ore is from the Iron Range. So what is American-made steel? We will be working more on this issue because the last thing I want to do is start a trade war. And I've got more information with, the United States steel workers. They're supportive of doing trade with Canada because a lot of our ore goes up there. So we got to be a little careful. And when I'm negotiating with the ambassador of Canada, I will bring that up.
Representative New.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifiers, you had mentioned a number of different groups who like the housing provisions of the bill. I'm just wondering more broadly, is St. Luke's on board with the bill as well?
Either of the testifiers?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I can't speak on behalf of St. Luke's. I know Essentia has had conversations with St. Luke's, and I know St. Luke's is engaging their lobbying folks in terms of this bill as well. So they're certainly interested in a number of the housing issues and the possibility of creating those housing opportunities. But I really have to be very careful about speaking on behalf of St. Luke's here.
Is that a representative?
That's fine.
Representative McQuaid.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifiers, one of the things we're hearing a lot about is our shrinking workforce, and one of the other things we also hear about is the mental health crisis. And so I just want to look a little bit about what mental health and how that will play into this vision, because I think it could be really beneficial to keep more folks in Minnesota's
workforce.
So, Mr. Chairman, Representative, thanks for your question. There's a lot we do for behavioral health presently in our Duluth campus. This vision that's described here would allow us to expand that, particularly with trying to make more emergency space available specifically for our patients who have behavioral health needs acutely. Right now, we see them in St. Mary's Medical Center in ED. It's not a good space for them to start their healing process. And we would envision to more of a space in actually Central Health Duluth, formerly known as Miller-Guam Medical Center, for that type of emergency space. and then likewise to continue to use our spaces that we have there now. We've expanded beds in that hospital. We have now 38 inpatient beds for behavioral health patients, and continue to use that from a spectrum of care, from an emergency to inpatient care to outpatient care. It's very much part of what we do, and we'll continue to do so.
Representative O'Neill, and then Dabney. And as a reminder to members of the committee, we have two more bills on the agenda and the governor's supplemental budget review. So, oh, and Scott, too. So, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a really quick question. Since we do have the tax chair here, I'm just wondering if you could let us know what the total impact to the state and local taxpayers would be for this project.
Chairman Davis.
As former Majority Leader Valenti would say, the situation is fluid. And how many times did he say that? But to answer the question, it's not going to be as it's in the bill now. Because what the bill says now, it's $15 million for until you get to $187 million or something like that. The question has become, and my first question was, where's the skin in the game for the city? Mm-hmm. And so we're coming up with various ideas of how we can do that. And I know it's not DMC, but with DMC, the city and the county stepped up. Mm-hmm. And we don't have that answer yet. But in the bill, if this bill is passed like this, it's $15 million a year and Keller's $187 million. So it's 12, 13 or something like that. That's not how it's going to end up.
184.
Or 184.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I apologize. I was in and out presenting a bill in another committee. I was just talking to my seatmate here, and he said that the hospital that you're planning to rebuild is going to have the same number of beds, but they're going to be private rooms instead. And in relation to what Representative May Quay brought up about mental health, I'm just wondering if there's a demand for more rooms. I mean, I equate this to building an elementary school in a growing community, and by the time the school is built, then it's already bursting at the seams. And I just wondered if, you know, I'm sure you guys have done all this planning that's gone into this, but if you could just speak to some of those concerns, I would appreciate it.
The testifiers.
So, Mr. Chairman, Representative, thanks for your question. So we are in the midst of a very detailed planning process and would envision replacing the same number of beds. As healthcare has changed, those beds are going to be filled by patients that are even sicker than there are there today. At the same time, our plans are to have those beds to be very fluid and flexible, such that a patient who needs ICU care can be have done in the same bed without having to go to a different floor or a different unit. And so that we're building really the flexibility into that, and when we're finally finished with our plans and drawings, I think it'll be designed in such a way that there will be room for expansion. But I would envision the expansion will really be more on the outpatient side, the ambulatory side, as the way medicine is going in general.
Thank you.
Representative Dabney. Representative Metza, you'll get the last word. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I wanted to pick up where Representative May Quaid started in terms of behavioral health services, mental health services. Representative Backer, and I just had a bill up for school-linked mental health services. And one of the challenges in Greater Minnesota is the lack of clinicians available. How does Essentia interact with training providers who would then also hopefully stay and practice outside the metro area?
The testifier.
Or how would this assist in that?
The testifier.
So, Mr. Chairman, Representative, thank you. So, there's many different training programs that we're present with right now, and there are behavioral health professionals that train with us in a variety of programs, whether they're in a social work status, a counselor status, a psychology status, and that's part of our mission. We'll continue to do that. We're not leaving the behavioral health space. Recognize we need far more resources in that regard, from inpatient care to outpatient care.
Mm-hmm.
We've invested in taking those same resources when we in having them those same colleagues and professionals embedded in our primary care clinics. As you point out, with the pediatric population, it's a special need on the school because of kids need to stay in school to meet their milestones and not get behind. And those folks are especially helpful in doing that. And so we remain very committed to that. It's part of our mission. It's not going away. How it will look 5 or 10 years from now, I would only speculate, except to say I know it's part of our mission. And unfortunately, with behavioral health, there's a great need, almost an inexhaustible need
mm-hmm.
right now. And I could go on and on. We don't have time for that as to those whys. We're here to stay with serving our patients with behavioral health.
Thank you, Doctor. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So we're going to Representative Anderson and then Representative Metz. You have the last words, Bill. Representative Anderson.
Thank you. Very quick. Thanks, Mr. Chair. The university was mentioned up there. What about the other hospital in town? Is that being consulted in any of these plans or going forward?
Testifiers.
The other hospital, Mr. Chairman, Representative, as Representative Neal had indicated, Duluth is a two healthcare system community. Essentia is far away, the larger of the two, but St. Luke's is also operating in the city of Duluth. This bill lays out a medical district, and that district encompasses both hospital systems in its footprint. And so while this bill is about Essentia's development, and when we talk about some of the demands and some of the growth opportunities, St. Luke's, as I understand from them, is also doing expansions as well, you know, in similar time frames. So there's a lot going on in the broad-based medical community up there with both healthcare systems, and this bill's footprint encompasses, for the public infrastructure discussion and where those costs are done, encompasses both those healthcare footprints.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Darren Macbeth representing St. Luke's, and per the question and on this topic, yes, St. Luke's has been participating in discussions, though with a concept this large and complex and some of the newer rollout, including the Delete Everything Amendment that has been referenced today. We're still getting our arms around many of the consequences, including the makeup of the newly proposed advisory board that St. Luke's is not currently a part of, and so there's more discussions that need to be had, and St. Luke's is in the process of engaging in more of those discussions, so to be continued.
Thank you. Representative Metz.
Thank you, Ms. Chair, and Representative Fabian. I'll look forward to making sure this stays in the bill, the American-made steel. I wanted to just give Chair David's quick reference. The Bay Bridge was $1 billion over budget with additional construction costs because of faulty design from foreign steel. And again, the amendment, I think we can work on it, make sure it adheres to all of our trade laws. But it is important, I know, just on the Highway 53 bridge that we all worked on together bipartisanly, too, there were 10 million pounds of American-made steel that went into that, the stadium. And I think it's a good addition to the bill, and like that it's in there from the beginning. One other thing that Representative O'Neill had asked about the jobs. And we know that there will be millions of hours of construction over the course of 4 years and a project labor agreement, which is in the letter from Representative Moline, but I thought it important just to put that on the record. And those are all very good paying jobs with benefits and will keep many families, even from my district, working.
Representative Davis, I'm familiar with the policy down in Rochester, kind of related to DMC, called the Greg David's Good Neighbor Policy. Is there going to be a Good Neighbor Policy up in the Duluth bill, or is that remain to be seen?
Mr. Chairman, as you know, the Greg David's Good Neighbor Policy, like the Good Neighbor Greg David's is there, was from a different bill, not from DMC itself. It was from the sales tax extension, but never underestimate my sneakiness.
Yeah. Any closing comments, Representative Davis?
Yes, and thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, for a very, very good hearing to get these issues out on the table. I'd like to thank the City of Duluth. I'd like to thank Essentia Health and my co-authors, and they seem to be growing every day with folks getting on this bill, but Representative Schultz, Representative Murphy, and Olson have put a lot of time in this bill, too, and I really appreciate that. And so with that, I do want you to know that I was invited to run in Grandma's Marathon, and I said I'll go to Grandma's and have special number two. So
I really
appreciate your support, Mr. Chairman.
With that, Representative Davis renews his motion to have House File 3711 as amended, recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Taxes. I when I said Representative Davis, I meant me. Yeah, so all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. Right away, back to your committee. Thank you, Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
Representative Davis, can we call this the Don't Think Twice It's All Right Bill?
Representative Johnson, you're up next. Representative Johnson. Oh,
Representative New moves that House File 3933 be considered for possible inclusion in a later bill. Representative Johnson to your bill.
Mr. Chair, committee members, this bill before you today is a simple bill. It provides limited amount of much-needed funding to a very valuable program, not just in my community, but throughout the state. I would help many Minnesotans support Minnesotans with disabilities to reach their employment goals. With me today is Mary Kay Kennedy, with PAC, who will describe the bill.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, I'm Mary Kay Kennedy. I'm with Advocating Change Together. So I wanted to thank you, Representative Johnson, for helping us with this bill, and Representative New as well. And, of course, to recognize Karen Clark for her decades of work with disability equality in Minnesota. So I do understand, Mr. Chair, that this is a busy time of the session, and I'm especially appreciative of having the opportunity to give testimony, and I promise to keep my testimony to just a few short minutes. Again, I'm Mary Kay, the Executive Director with ACT, Center for Disability Leadership. ACT is a disability equality organization run by and for people with developmental and other disabilities. There is a disparity between the rights people have and the rights that they are actually able to exercise. So supporting to people to understand their rights and to understand the services that can help them get more of what they want out of life is a fundamental piece to fixing this disparity. ACT offers many programs and events each year to help people gain knowledge and skills to live more independent lives. The bill before you today focuses on one of our specific programs called Explore, Prepare, ACT, Finding the Job You Want. The program is a three-part workshop that addresses common barriers to employment. It helps people make educated choices about whether work in the community is right for them. It lets them know the steps they need to take to find jobs in the community. During the first of the sessions, we help people just explore the kinds of employment they might like. They identify their strengths and interests and just think together about what kind of a job might be right for them. The second session practices on practicing advocating for what they want, just practicing helping to tell their parents and social workers and case managers that they might want to take some steps towards more competitive employment. During the final session of the workshop, we help folks identify who might help them reach their goals. So they identify people that can support them around their employment goals, and they all leave the sessions with concrete plans for what their next steps will be. We follow up with the participants 3 months after the program, and we use an outside evaluator just to help us gather the information. So in the follow-up, we find that 80% of the program participants say that the program really did help them get started on starting a job search. 26 of the participants actually found jobs in the community and reported that they really liked their jobs in the community. We actually asked several of the program participants to join us today for this testimony, and I'm delighted to report that everyone that we asked was working, so they were not able to come. So Explore, Prepare, ACT gives people the skills and power to overcome barriers to community employment. This program has historically been funded through DEED, but we were informed by DEED staff just this last summer that would no longer be possible. Therefore, we are asking for your support today on legislation that will provide extremely valuable funding to allow ACT to continue offering the Explore, Prepare, ACT, Finding the Job You Want program. Thank you again for this opportunity.
Thank you, Ms. Kennedy. Representative Johnson, do you have any other invited testifiers today?
I do not.
Thank you. Are there any member questions for this testifier? Representative Mahoney.
Thank you. And this is a question for the chair or for staff. The last line, the base level funding for this program shall be $50,000. Does that mean that this is now in base funding out of the Workforce Development Fund?
Thank you, Mr. Mahoney. Thank you, Representative Mahoney. So, just staff, please.
Madam Chair,
Representative Mahoney, yes, that means that we would, it would be part of base funding going forward.
Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chairman, is this base funding out of the workforce, the workforce development fund?
Mm-hmm. To the staff.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes.
Representative Mahoney. This is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public that would like to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, any other member questions? Seeing none, any closing comments? Representative Johnson.
Chair, I just want to thank you for considering this bill and hopefully it continues moving forward.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. And this bill will be laid out for possible inclusion. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Mahoney. Hello, how are you doing?
Representative Mahoney, you have House File 3749, and this will be laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will explain the bill. I need the page to hand out this when he gets a minute. We all know about the Emerald Bill and how it's coming at us and taking out hundreds of millions of trees, maybe even a billion trees. This bill establishes a program in the Department of Ag to assist a cogeneration facility to assist the counties in the XL Energy Ratepayers area to move the emerald ash borer trees that have been removed down to District Energy in St. Paul. What it will do is allow them to grind these trees up. And I'm not sure whether it's sawdust-sized particles or smaller, but it kills all the EEAB bugs. And so that it's not a matter of studying them. They are at this particular point going to take over the whole state. Wisconsin has just declared a total quarantine this afternoon or yesterday. I won't try to kid you or hide anything from you. This is there's only one facility that works for this. This is a biomass energy plant in St. Paul. The reason it does work, not like Benson or Laurentian, is that it is a cogeneration. It provides heat for 80% of the buildings in downtown St. Paul. It provides heat for the Capitol complex and a variety of other places, and sells power. I thought it's probably my fault. There was supposed to be an amendment to this bill, and I know I saw it. I know I saw it on my emails. I probably just didn't copy it and get it down to you, which allows for, I think it's 2% administration fees. Is that correct?
To the staff.
Madam Chair, Representative Mahoney, that's correct.
Representative Mahoney.
For administration fees with the Department of Admin, Agriculture. In the bill, it just talks about what it can be used for, which is essentially to get the trees to St. Paul and grind them. Because, again, I don't have the expertise to get you into the weeds on how small they have to be in order to kill all the emerald ash borer larvae. But I am told it is very, very small, and it's relatively expensive. This bill appropriates $6 million a year beginning this year through 2023. And it ends when the power, let me get to where I wrote that down. It ends when the power purchase agreement ends in 2023. I have some testifiers for this bill, and I would like to turn it over to them.
Thank you, Representative Mahoney. To the testifier, if you could please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
Yes, thank you. My name is Victoria Reinhart. I'm on the Ramsey County Board of Commissioners, and I also chair the Partnership on Waste and Energy, and that's a joint powers board between Hennepin, Ramsey, and Washington counties. And I'm here today to speak in favor of House File 3749. Emerald ash borer, as we know, kills ash trees. And as Representative Mahoney stated, the ash trees are susceptible to the EAB, and it has already infested trees in 16 Minnesota counties, including Ramsey County. I do have a handout that we will, it wasn't supplied to you in paper form, but we will make sure that you get that, that shows the number of trees, the tons of ash that goes into these facilities or that is potentially out there. It will impact every ash tree. We know that. There are the volume of the woody waste will increase as the infestation of the trees with emerald ash borer continues to accelerate. I think right now we're kind of in this prime time where we need to start to manage it right now. Preliminary analysis has shown that there are at least 2.95 million ash trees in the 7-county metro area alone, all of which will in time succumb to EAB. Those trees will result in over 1.67 million tons of wood waste requiring disposal. And when we look at things through the Partnership on Waste and Energy, we really are looking at not only the economic impact, but obviously the environmental impact of losing those trees, and it is substantial. The cost of removing and replacing a single tree can range from hundreds to thousands of dollars. And again, we're talking about 2.95 in the metro area alone. Wood waste generated by local units of government, municipalities, tree services, and businesses which don't use our sites needs to be managed. The expected significant increase in the volume due to EAB will need to be handled in ways that protect health and the environment. Wood waste that results from the trimming or cutting down shrubs and trees can be an important resource, and that's one of the things that I know Evergreen and District Energy will go into in more detail, but it is an important resource. And almost all of the wood waste right now from emerald ash borer is being delivered as a fuel to be used by St. Paul Cogen, which I just call District Energy. So... and Evergreen. So there's a lot of new things that I'm learning today. Anyhow, and it does generate steam for heating and cooling in St. Paul and also produces electricity. Beyond St. Paul Cogen, other reliable markets for this material are difficult to find, if not impossible. The material, by law, cannot be landfilled. It cannot be put in the trash for delivery to a resource recovery facility. Nor is open burning allowed, thank goodness. One option is landscape mulch, but markets for that material are nearly at capacity, and even if you turn it into mulch, it has to stay within the quarantine area, which was one of the first questions I had. So we also know that other plant diseases are emerging, which will lead to even more wood waste resulting from damaged and dying trees. This is an issue that needs to be addressed regionally and before the volumes of wood waste grow with the advancing ash disease epidemic. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Reinhart. Next testifier, can you please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony?
Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Jeff Gilmet. I'm the Biomass Fuel Manager for Environmental Wood Supply, an affiliate of Evergreen Energy and District Energy St. Paul. Environmental Wood Supply is a regional processor of tree waste that our team processes into wood chips to fuel St. Paul cogeneration facility. Each year we process approximately 270,000 tons of tree waste into boiler fuel used to produce renewable electricity and heat. EWS works with cities, counties, private landowners, and businesses who need help dealing with tree waste from tree trimming, storms, disease infestation, and other compromised trees. We provide an efficient process for managing these woodway streams with the additional benefit of converting it to renewable energy resource. Since the discovery in the metro area in 2008, we have been one of the primary outlets for emerald ash borer contaminated tree waste. We have helped curb the spread of emerald ash borer by working with state agencies, communities, and wood haulers that follow guidelines for species containment. Over just the last 5 years, we have collected tree waste from over 115 communities, turned it into biomass fuel for the combined heat and power plant. As emerald ash borer has begun to spread, we have been seeing a steady increase in the volume of EAB contaminated material we handle each year. In 2017, we saw a significant increase. Last year, almost 50% of the total tree waste we processed was from emerald ash borer, infested trees removed from public and private lands. In our recent conversations with local government agencies, we've learned that the volume of ash trees affected by EAB would produce over 1.67 million tons of tree waste requiring disposal. To give you a sense of what it will take to move that amount of material in the form of wood chips, it would take over 75,000 tractor trailers to transport that amount of material. In its 15 years of operation, the combined heat and power facility has been a solution for disposing of the region's tree waste. By working with communities from across the region, we have eased the burden on local government, helping them to manage the tree waste from their communities by processing it and turning it into renewable energy. County and state agencies have made it clear that the management of tree waste will become a greater challenge as emerald ash borer takes on a stronger hold on the region. The proposed program would help support processing, logistics, and managing the EAB issue. I thank you for your time, Madam Chair and members, and I look forward to your questions.
Thank you, Mr. Gelmet. I believe Representative Munson has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The question from the testifier is, did your organization participate in any similar programs during the Betjeman disease outbreak that we had 20 years ago? And if so, was that successful? Or?
Mr. Gelmet?
Unfortunately, we weren't in the business of burning wood then, so no, we were not involved. The city, Representative Mahoney can answer that, I think.
Representative Mahoney.
At one particular time, as all of us in politics know, sometimes the stories grow a little bit, but when the Dutch elm disease trees in St. Paul were collected, there was a football-sized field about 200 or 300 feet high down at Pig's Eye, on the other side of Pig's Eye Waste Center. And one night, the mayor at the time got a phone call from the fire department saying there's a fire in the Dutch elm trees. And he said, you don't have to get to it till the day after tomorrow. I won't tell you the mayor's name, but he's a god in our city at some time. So it burned, is essentially what happened.
Representative
Munson.
Madam Chair, the follow-up question I had was, does the $6 million that AIG asked for, does this cover the cost of the removal of the trees or just the grinding? In other words, are private companies still going to be bidding for the removal of these trees?
Representative Munson.
Madam Chair, Representative Munson, this only covers the fuel preparation, so no, it doesn't cover anything removing the trees. And this primarily works on public lands, so the trees that we remove from public land. I have what I'm sure is an infested tree on my personal property, and I'll have to pay the several hundred or several thousand dollars to get it removed and disposed of.
Okay.
Representative Munson?
Thank you very much. That's all my questions.
Okay. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the testifier, this interests me as a farmer about burning and drying things. do these wood chips have to be dried to some extent before you can burn them in your process?
Mr. Belknap.
Madam Chair, Representative, no, they don't go in through any drying process. It's a natural process once the wood is ground once and hauled back to our main wood yard. It's ground again, and it just loses moisture content from that process. You're going from about 45-plus in moisture percentage down to 30 or 35, depending on weather conditions.
Representative Anderson.
And then one more follow-up. Thank you, Madam Chair. Currently, the wood mass you burn, does it have any value? I mean, do you have to pay a price for this, or do people pay to have it on delivery to your facility?
Mr. Duncan.
Madam Chair, Representative, for the most part, we do pay for some wood that's processed that comes to our wood yard, and it's been gone through phase one processing, so we do pay for some of that wood. Brush and logs that are brought down to our wood yard, we do not pay for. We don't charge either. We go off-site as well and grind in a 50-60 mile radius for urban wood waste, and historically we have not charged for that service as well.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Now, this is an issue that we're going to have to face pretty soon. We've talked about this in the Ag Committee, and thanks, Representative, for bringing it up. And in the cities here, it's going to be a huge issue, so we need to address it, so thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To Representative Anderson, I hope you took a look at this list that I sent out. This is not just the metro area. This is Dodge County, Goodhue, Le Sueur, Sibley, Wright County. So it goes quite a ways beyond just the seven or nine county metro area where they draw wood from. So this bill is designed to take wood and this money from the RDA to serve the whole XL Energy ratepayers area. It's kind of a way for that money that ratepayers pay for the dry cask storage to come back into the system back in who's paying for it, basically. So.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks again, Madam Chair. I did look at this. My home county is Polk County, and part of that county is served by Xcel, and they're not on the list. Does it have to be entirely served by Xcel?
Representative Mahoney.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, I don't know the answer to that question. I can find out for you.
Thanks.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm curious on, I serve on the Environment Committee, and we do a lot of permitting with MPCA. I'm curious to know what kind of processes, what emission standards you have to meet on your discharge, or if you have to have an MPCA air permit at your facility.
Mr. Gelmet, or welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record, and then you can continue to answer this question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Nina Axelson, representing Evergreen Energy. So the St. Paul Cogeneration Facility has a permit, and then also the activities of Environmental Wood Supply, about a mile and a half, 2 miles away from St. Paul Cogeneration, also operating under the MPCA permit, and then District Energy St. Paul as the heating and cooling facility. All of those are obligated under the MPCA activities permit. Structure.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm curious to know what I'm sure there's no one here from MPCA, but I can get these answers later. I'm just wondering what the standards are. We've had discussions in this committee. Representative Anderson and I represent areas of the state where we have manufacturers that produce hydronic heaters, and the requirements that have been placed upon them have become very, very stringent. To the point of almost putting these companies out of business. And I'm just curious to know, I'll ask MPCA to see if you are required to meet the same standards that they are, so I can have another conversation with somebody else. Thank you.
Representative Mahoney or anyone else want to respond to that first before we move on? No? Okay. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had a question. I noticed that this assistance is just for removing trees from public land. And I know a lot of the places where we're going to have some issues is going to be private land as well. Is there any plan for looking at that? opportunity and need.
Representative Mahoney.
Madam Chair, I try to keep my bills as simple as possible. No.
Follow-up, Representative Clark.
No, Madam Chair, maybe it's something you can look into.
Thank you. All right, Ms. Axelson, you haven't had a chance to testify. Did you have additional testimony that you'd like to offer?
Nope, just here to help with questions.
All right, very well. Any other member questions? Baker, Representative Baker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question for the author. Maybe I missed this earlier, Representative Mahoney. Why $6 million a year? Is that a magic number to get the output of the energy at a certain point, or is that hard numbers of what it's going to cost to bring in so many tons of wood? Maybe I missed that earlier, but why $6 million?
Representative Mahoney.
Because it's less than the wrenching and more than dense.
That's where I'm going with, yeah.
I don't have a good answer for you. The $6 million, I'm sure we could find out, but that was the number. This bill was to come forward last year during the big RDF kind of conversation. It really wasn't ready for prime time last year. And the parties have worked together to try to find some solutions. There are still some concerns, small concerns with XL. There's some small concerns with the way the bill is written for almost every party. So it's a work in progress. But again, those, you know, they're very small kind of issues. They want a clearer definition of how they would do the grants at the Department of Ag. Yeah, so they're just small things, so, but I can certainly find out why the $6 million, that magic number is.
Okay, I actually have a question. Representative Mahoney, could this program be operated by the Department of Commerce?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear.
I said, could this program be operated by the Department of Commerce or possibly DNR? Representative Mahoney.
We're a legislature. We can do anything we want. But trees are kind of a crop, so to speak, in Minnesota, so that's why we went there. I would have to talk to the two departments.
Thank you. And then also, Representative Mahoney, would this result in any fuel cost savings passed on to XL Energy ratepayers?
It's a thank you, Madam Chair. It's a relatively complicated way that they're doing it. But they're taking money out of XL ratepayers' pockets to pay for the dry cask storage. This will reduce that dollar. This won't reduce that at all. What it will do is it will reduce the pass-through cost that XL has to pay to Evergreen. And in that fashion, I'm sure it will come up at the next PUC rate hearing.
Thank you, Representative Mahoney. Any other member questions? All right, this is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public that would like to testify for or against this bill? Come on down. XL Energy is coming down.
Here you go,
right? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Rick Evans with XL Energy. I just want to make sure the committee understands. First of all, I want to say we appreciate Representative Mahoney and the folks that are up here at the table who have expressed willingness to sit down and work with us on this bill. We do have some continuing concerns, but we're talking about that, and so we expect we'll be able to resolve that. But in answer to the chair's question, you know, we have a power purchase agreement with District Energy under the old biomass mandate that we spent a lot of time on last year. And we purchase, the way that works, as Representative Mahoney referred to, was the fuel costs are passed through dollar for dollar to us. So whatever they pay for fuel is passed through directly to us. So one of the things we want to make sure is clear in the bill is that whatever money is devoted to this process of gathering and processing fuel, that our customers realize that savings when the costs are passed through to our customers. Our power purchase agreement requires the facility to burn a certain amount of wood, so this wood will help them meet their requirement under our power purchase agreement, but we would hope to get the benefit of that. The other thing I'll mention, just to make sure it's mentioned, because we had last year, and I know we're going to have this year, ongoing discussions about the closure of the other two biomass facilities. We need to be careful that we're not creating another situation so that 5 years from now we suddenly have created a whole other industry that now has to be preserved. And so we want to continue to work with the author and with the group just to make sure that we don't end up in a situation in 5 years like we were in last year, where suddenly the opportunity to save money for our customers on this relatively expensive energy is being driven by other economic factors.
Thank you, Mr. Evans. And can you remind the committee just one more time, how expensive is this energy?
Well, I can't speak directly for the St. Paul Cogen facility, in part because I don't know and in part because I believe it's confidential. But, you know, this is, you know, the biomass energy in general across the plants, you know, is pretty expensive, like about $150 a megawatt hour. But that's not any reflection on St. Paul Cogen. I don't know what their charges are. Could be, you know, it certainly is different than that.
Any other final member questions? Seeing none, any other members of the public that want to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, final comments, Representative Mahoney.
I hope this bill gets laid over and included in the omnibus bill, but hopefully we will be a very thin bill this year.
Thank you, Representative Mahoney. And with that, we'll lay this bill over for possible inclusion in a later bill. And that was House Bill 3749.
Members, the final item on our agenda is the governor's supplemental budget. So if we have the governor's staff and commissioners come forward.
Totally served by Excel.
Yeah. Commissioner Hardy, is it okay if we start with your department first? Is that all right?
Yep.
So, oh, I'm sorry. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today regarding the governor's supplemental budget recommendations. For the record, my name is Shantara Hardy, and I'm the commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development, DEED for short. As you know, DEED's mission is to enhance the economic success of individuals, businesses, and communities by improving opportunities for prosperity and independence across our great state. The governor's supplemental budget recommendations support this mission by, number one, maintaining our existing levels of agency funding, but also making needed investments to ensure that the state's economy remains strong and competitive. The recommendations are highlighted. You all should have received the one pager in your packet, and it goes over each of the recommendations. So I'll try to just go through each of them briefly in my presentation. So the first one, which is the largest one, is broadband. This first recommendation is related to increasing funding in the amount of $30 million for fiscal year 2019 for the Border to Border Broadband Development Grant Program. And as you know, this program funds expansion of services in areas of Minnesota that are unserved or underserved. This recommended funding level is expected to expand access to more than 11,000 households, businesses, community, and education institutions. Since taking office, Governor Dayton, in partnership with you all, has secured $85.6 million for investments in high-speed internet infrastructure. In 2011, only 50% of Minnesotans, largely in urban areas, had access to those speeds. To date, this funding has expanded access to broadband for approximately 33,000 households, 5,000 businesses, and 300 institutions, leveraging approximately $110 million in matching investments. Today, thanks to your work and the governor's work with these investments, 88% of Minnesotans have access to broadband speeds that meet the 2020 goal. The next recommendation is the Angel Tax Credit Program. This program, I just wanted just to mention it for you all. It is a part of the governor's tax bill, but wanted to make sure you were aware of the request of $10 million in fiscal year 2019 for the program to fund calendar year 2018. The program provides a 25% credit to investors or investment funds that put money into startup companies focused on high technology or other proprietary products, processes, and services in specialized fields. This initiative has helped over 345 Minnesota businesses in growing industries, giving them access to much-needed startup capital. As you all may recall, this tax credit expired at the end of last year, and so this is a request to bring this back. As you look at the continuum of investments in businesses here in our state, currently we have no tool to invest in startups at the state level. So it's very critical that if we wish to remain competitive and a place where startups start, we need to make sure that we have tools necessary for us to make those investments. The third recommendation is from the Minnesota Investment Fund. There's language to request for investment in a paper mill in Duluth. The governor recommends one-time language to be added to the fiscal year 2019 MIF appropriation. This language sets aside $2 million of the existing MIF appropriation for the mill in Duluth, assisting the plant to upgrade its facilities and retain employees. And unfortunately, the representative from the Verso Duluth Mill couldn't be here, so I'll, as best as I can, answer the questions you have, not into benefits or anything like that, but I'll try to answer your questions. The last two recommendations are for direct appropriations to three organizations, the Family Partnership.
Commissioner, I'm sorry. I apologize. I didn't want to waste your time. So those are bonding projects that we're not going to have jurisdiction over, so I don't know if you still wanted to cover those or not.
Just want to make sure if anyone has any questions.
Yeah, go ahead and cover them. That's fine.
I don't have to.
I didn't want to slight you, but I should have talked to you before.
In closing, I will say over the past 7 years, Minnesota's economy has improved and today is one of the strongest and diverse in the nation. And we are committed and continue to work hard every day to provide pathways for Minnesotans to achieve prosperity and independence. These budget recommendations will ensure that Minnesota remains on the right track. And so I thank you all again for the time to testify, and I'm happy to entertain any questions.
Thank you, Commissioner. My apologies. I was not trying to, although I noticed that you had the opportunity to reach for the exit, and you immediately ran for it. So that was good. Any questions or comments from members of the committee? Thank you, Commissioner. Good to see you. Thank you. Next, Housing Finance. And Commerce, you're on deck. Oh, just those two? Okay. No one from Workers' Comp or Dahlia? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Tingerthal, and I'm the commissioner at the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. Thank you for the opportunity to come and talk to you today about those items that were included in the governor's budget message on Friday. First of all, I do want to mention that Minnesota Housing also has a request in the capital investment bill. I'll just mention it here. It is a request for $100 million in housing infrastructure bonds and $15 million in general obligation bonds. These bonds are used for four purposes: permanent supportive housing for people experiencing homelessness, preservation of existing federally assisted housing, acquisition of land by community land trusts, renovation of public housing, and we are recommending this year an additional eligible activity for senior housing for low-income seniors. Over the last 6 years, with this program that was developed by the legislature in 2012, we have preserved or created over 6,000 units of housing. So we'll be talking in detail about that with the Capital Investment Committee. We are bringing back in the governor's budget a request for a program that you heard about last year, which is called Homework Starts with Home. This is essentially the continuation of a program that we did as a pilot program in the city of St. Paul, city of Minneapolis, and Clay County over the last several years. It was previously known as the Program for Highly Mobile Students. We were able to do a evaluation of that pilot program, and I'm very pleased to say that we found, as a result of the research, that 90% of the participating students in that program, where they received rental assistance during the time that they were engaged in a program like the Promise Neighborhoods or the Northside Achievement Zone, over 90% of the participants maintained housing stability during the course of the period that was evaluated. It also strengthened the attendance of students whose families received the rental assistance, which was really our goal. As many of you know, if you don't have kids going to school, it's very tough for them to make achievement in school and to increase their learning opportunities. The statistics that we know is that this program has been successful in the limited area. What Homework Starts with Home will do is to allow us to expand that to additional districts beyond the original three. And we know that in 77 of 87 Minnesota counties, there are 1,241 different schools. And in 77 of those, there are kids that are classified as homeless or highly mobile. So this is not just a program for the metro area. It is one that school districts and principals around the state have told us would be valuable to them. And that is over 9,000 students that were identified as homeless or highly mobile during the course of the past year. The final thing that I want to mention to you is an improvement in the Manufactured Home Relocation Trust Fund, which many of you may not even know exists. This is a program that's been available for some time. It is actually funded by a small fee that is charged on every single lot in manufactured home parks throughout the state. This is a fee that's charged annually. And right now, the law limits the amount of fees that can be collected to a total of $1 million. Once the fund reached that $1 million level, it then clicks off for the entire next year. So it ceases to collect the fee. Once the fund drops below $1 million, the fee clicks back on the following year. So the issue is that we have had some fairly large closures in the last year and essentially wiped out the fund. And it generally takes about 2.5 years of collecting fees to get back up to the $1 million. So if we face a park closure in the next year, we'll be very strapped for funds to be able to pay relocation for these individuals who own mobile homes in these mobile home parks that are closing. So the request is to increase that click-off level to $3 million from the current $1 million, because our experience in the recent couple of years is that the $1 million simply is not a high enough level to be able to maintain funds in this trust fund. The bill will also make a few other adjustments to the trust fund so it can run more efficiently and effectively. And we are in conversations with the park owners about these changes, and I know that there has been some testimony in the Senate regarding this. So that's a preview of what you can expect to see from us this year.
Thank you, Commissioner. One quick question for me before we go to member questions. I'm looking at your handout. This is the handout you gave out. I'm just curious when Housing Finance changed their prefixes to 196 instead of 296 for your phone number on the bottom. You guys get a separate...
Yeah, right.
Representative West.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I actually have heard of the Manufactured Home Relocation Fund, and I have a bill doing that exact thing, so I'm happy to see the governor supports it. And my district has a very high per capita manufactured housing living there, so it's a very important issue, and I'm glad to see it's included.
Any other questions or comments? Well, Representative Vogel.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just testify or to the spreadsheet. I'm curious now when we're talking about that cap going from $1 million to $3 million, I'm assuming that would have $2 million of revenue or thereabouts, but I don't see it on the spreadsheet. I'm just curious how the spreadsheet is prepared relative to any of the fee increases that might be coming down the road relative to the governor's proposal.
Mr. Zempel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vogel, the manufactured home relocation trust fund change item, I take it that's what your question is in reference to?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Zempel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vogel, I don't believe the request is a fee increase, and so it hasn't shown up in the spreadsheet as such.
Well, I'm sorry, what's line 54 in the spreadsheet then?
My apologies.
Representative Vogel, that the spreadsheet's not going to show the trust fund balance. It is going to show what the new revenue would be, and so you can see they're estimating what that revenue increase would be. Mr. Zempel, correct me if I'm wrong, that what you see is on line 54, those would be the estimates of how much new revenue would be yielded before the $3 million cap was reached in those fiscal years. Is that correct, Mr. Zempel?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay. So there isn't any new revenue this year. It would be coming all in the next biennium.
Well, just to represent it, and Mr. Zempel, correct me if I'm wrong, but so it's anticipated that there's going to be revenue this year, regardless of whether we take legislative action. The question is, when does it reach that $1 million cap, and does the assessment continue? And it appears that the estimates are that that would be reached in fiscal year 21.
Thank you.
Mr. Zempel, am I right?
That'd be correct, Mr.
Okay.
Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments from members of the committee? Representative Fabian?
I'll go to... thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, thank you for being here. As you know, I've worked a lot on workforce housing and have a bill this year from the last session, House File 1535, and what we're doing is trying to capture some of the growth in the mortgage and deed tax to be going to home ownership, and we've expanded who that's available to. I'm looking at spreadsheet line 44. Homework starts with home, the governor's recommendation. How do these two things sync up, if at all, in the governor's recommendations?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative Fabian, I would say that they are unrelated. As you may be aware, for the workforce housing bill, there was language that was added to our statute 2 years ago, and there was an appropriation in that year of $750,000 for that program, and that allowed us to run a small pilot. We selected four projects, two of which actually involved manufactured home parks, and two of which involved single family, one in the metro area, one in northern Minnesota. And at that time, there was a discussion about the capturing the increase in fees. As we considered it within the framework that we were given to consider appropriation item requests for this year, it felt as though the revenue that would be generated if, in fact, the capture was done was beyond the parameters of what we would have requested for this year. So it's not that we think it's a bad idea. It just did not fit the parameters we were given for requesting budget items.
John Fabian.
Thank you. Thanks for the cool water. I was hoping that this would be more of a priority for you and the administration. I'm hoping that we can continue some discussion. There's a lot of frustration that's been expressed to me about a lack of willingness in the administration to tackle this issue, and I hope we can do better. Thanks.
Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess one of the other issues that has not yet become before this committee, but really all has to do with families that probably are some of those thousands of children that we're talking about here, less families who have children who are lead poisoned. and families are either evicted or made homeless because of that issue or can't find a safe affordable housing. And I'm just wondering, do you have any numbers on that yourself for the, I know that you do deal with that issue within the agency and so on, probably across a number of different programs, and I'm just wondering if you would comment on how that might relate to the homework, with the kids who we're talking about here.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative Clark, I am not prepared to give any kinds of numbers today on the work that we do with regard to the removal of lead hazards. What I will say is that we do have a home improvement loan program that does require testing and removal of lead for any household that receives assistance under that program. With regard to this rental assistance, these rental assistance payments are used, they're administered by housing authorities throughout the state, and they would use their normal inspection requirements before approving a property where this rental assistance could be used.
Thank you.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I want to join with Representative Fabian in hoping that you folks will take a good look at the mortgage and deed capture, because I think that's a potentially valuable tool for construction, which is my understanding of the purpose of it. Am I correct that there's a difference between the purpose of Homework Starts at Home and the Representative Fabian's proposal around capturing the mortgage and deed tax, that that's for construction as opposed to rental assistance?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney, yes, that is correct. Two different programs, both very worthy programs, but different.
Okay.
Representative.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments from members of the committee? Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you.
And then is there anyone from Commerce, Workman's Comp, or Dolly here that wanted to testify the governor's budget recommendations or policy? Okay, I didn't. They have small, just really quickly, I'll just overview them for them. Department of Commerce has a, they want to, a current assessment that ends on June 30th, utility grid assessment extension. They're seeking to extend that by $500,000 a year. The Workman's Compensation Court of Appeals, and I apologize when I ask you publicly, Representative Mahoney, do you know if the Workman's Comp Board approved that recommendation to enhance the compensation for Workman's Comp judges?
Mr. Chair, do you mean the pay raise for the judges?
Correct.
Yes, they did. Well, they did today.
They did, okay. So
that will be coming in an amendment with a bunch of other things.
Okay. And again, members, just to remind everyone, when it comes to the Workers' Compensation Advisory Task Force, we, generally speaking, take their recommendations. So it's included in the governor's budget recommendation, and if it's been acted on by them, we would expect that. Representative Bonney.
Except it may take 3 or 4 years to come to an agreement with something.
And then beyond that, members, again, on your spreadsheet, there's some, you see the transfers out for the premium security plan, which are tracked in our committee, but really we don't have jurisdiction over. But then there's additional some additional policy and fine language there regarding OSHA and wage theft. And if you have any questions on those are detailed in the governor's documents online. So is there any other questions or comments from members of the committee? Seeing none, that completes our agenda for the day, and we are adjourned. Thank you.